That was Pins and Needles by Hawthorne Heights. And next up is my favorite by the Sleeping with Sirens. It's If You Can't Hang. So let's go.
The following program is a tribute to pioneering African-American journalist and former CNN chief anchor Bernard Shaw, who died on September 8, 2022. He was 82.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I have a montage of memories, proud ones, about CNN. It's hard to underscore one particular story because when you think back in 20 years, a lot has happened. We started out on the air in one century, we're in a new one. I would say collectively, my pride comes from the fact that more than 4,000 women and men at CNN around the United States, around the world, do the job day in and day out. We're responsible for reporting news that people can trust.
Retired renowned television journalist Bernard Shaw. Shaw covered many monumental 20th century events, from the Jonestown tragedy to Tiananmen Square, and he helped launch news network CNN as its chief anchor. While serving in the Marine Corps from 1959 to 1963, Shaw introduced himself to CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite, declaring his intention to join Cronkite at CBS in the future. The respected anchorman began his career in Chicago at WNUS-TV, then later joined CBS News and ABC News, becoming his Capitol Hill senior correspondent. Shaw retired from CNN in 2001 after being the face of the cable network since its inception in 1980. During that time, he commanded the anchor desk and boldly steered the national conversation, even when taking on positions of adversity. He is also remembered for his live reporting on the 1991 Gulf War. Shaw moderated the October 2000 vice presidential debate between Dick Cheney and Joe Lieberman. From 1992 until his retirement, Shaw anchored CNN's Inside Politics. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a Black History Month salute to former CNN news anchor Bernard Shaw in Black America.
I left ABC because something called Cable News Network was starting up, and they asked me if I was interested in becoming the principal Washington anchor for CNN, and because a dear friend of mine, George Watson, who was an ABC bureau chief and is now ABC Washington bureau chief, had come over here temporarily to start up this bureau. Because George was here, I came on board, and Dan Shore, whom I used to work with at CBS, he was here, and I felt that was good enough reason to join CNN.
Bernard Shaw was a tough anchor at CNN for more than 20 years until he retired in 2001. He described himself as a straight-laced, old-fashioned kind of journalist who sticks to the facts. He reported on the Jonestown massacre and on the pro-democracy demonstration in Tiananmen Square. He interviewed Saddam Hussein and reported from Iraq during the first Gulf War, giving minute-by-minute accounts of the bombing. He moderated presidential as well as vice presidential debates. Shaw was born in 1940 and he grew up in Chicago on the South Side. He learned to read when he was 3.5 years old. He attended the University of Illinois at Chicago from 1963 to 1968. He worked at CBS News and ABC News before joining CNN in 1980. Back when Shaw began his journalism career, there was absolutely no African-American correspondents at the major networks. Throughout his 20-year career at CNN, he racked up major journalism awards, including the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. In spring of 1985, In Black America traveled to Washington, D.C. to speak with Bernard Shaw.
It was all intentional. I wanted to do what I'm doing ever since I was 13, growing up in Chicago. Edward R. Murrow, of CBS fame, was my idol. He was the kind of journalist, the kind of interviewer, the kind of anchorman I wanted to be. And I felt that rather than major in journalism, I felt it was more important to get a perspective on this planet and how mankind has evolved, and I felt that history would be a good major for that. I knew that I could write and wanted to learn how to write better. I was in accelerated reading classes when I was going through the Chicago public school system and taking special writing courses, that kind of thing. So I always had the encouragement and the indication that if I pressed onward, I would develop further. So that's why I majored in history rather than journalism. Assuming that the writing and getting little odd jobs and sweeping out radio stations and working at newspapers and what have you, that would come later as it did.
Did you work in journalism while attending the University of Illinois, while you were pursuing a degree in history?
I was somewhat of a freak. I was working full-time at an all-news radio station, WNUS.
Full-time,
and carrying what we call the full boat. 14 hours on the quarter system at the University of Illinois. I almost had a nervous breakdown a couple of times, but the station was owned by a Texan, Gordon McClendon, and I would leave the campus at 2 in the afternoon, and I would work from 4 o'clock until midnight. And my off days were irregular. I think it was off something like Tuesday or Wednesday, which is the worst time to be off. But that was my career. That's what I wanted. The opportunity was there, and I just felt that I should make the sacrifices. I was working full-time at WNUS, and then I went to the Marshall Field TV station in Chicago, WFLD, Channel 32. And in 1968, I went to work for, well, after 32, I went to work for Westinghouse Broadcasting in Chicago, WIND, which at that time was the best radio news department in the whole city. And as you and your listeners know, Chicago is a highly competitive news town. Whose history goes back to the days of, well, even Hemingway used to be a reporter in Chicago. Ben Hecht, people like that, Sandy Van Oker, all of them have come out of the Chicago shop. I worked there, and Westinghouse in 68 promoted me and transferred me here to Washington. I covered the White House for a year, the last year of the Johnson administration, which meant a lot of commutes to Texas, to Austin and to San Antonio. I especially like Austin, came to know Austin because of the president going home on the weekends. In 71, CBS Network hired me here in Washington. I went to work for CBS and worked here in Washington as network correspondent for about 6 years. And after that, I'd always wanted to cover Latin America. It's my favorite place in this world outside the United States. And ABC News said, well, if you come to work for us, you can go down and be bureau chief and cover Latin America, which I did for 3 years. And I came back here in 1979, and after doing some duty in the Iranian hostage crisis over in Tehran, I left ABC because something called Cable News Network was starting up, and they asked me if I was interested in becoming the principal Washington anchor for CNN. And because a dear friend of mine, George Watson, who was an ABC bureau chief and is now ABC Washington bureau chief, had come over here temporarily to start up this bureau. Because George was here, I came on board. And Dan Shore, whom I used to work with at CBS, he was here, and I felt that was good enough reason to join CNN. And that's why we're sitting here in my office talking.
You mentioned that you covered the White House. What was it like being a black reporter covering the White House for America?
You could be a green reporter covering the White House, and it is an extraordinary experience. Lyndon Johnson was a character, as you know, and everyone knows. He was finishing out his term. He would not run again, but he still was a man who could draw a lot of interesting people around him and create news, as he did the last year. It was very interesting covering Lyndon Johnson. I think the best reporters per beat are at the White House, regardless of whether they're wire service reporters, newspaper reporters, magazine reporters, radio reporters, or television reporters. The best, the cream of the crop, are there. And it was a challenge to be a part of that group and to compete with those people. And I never viewed myself as, and still don't, I regard myself as a reporter who happens to be black rather than a black reporter. There were no problems. I encountered no problems because of color. There were times, though, when my color did play a role in perception or in people's reactions to me. Let me be more specific. Lyndon Johnson, the last 6 months of his administration, was the guest of many people who wanted to say, thank you, Mr. President, we know you're leaving office. And there were a series of farewell parties that became very boring here in Washington, because that's all we did was go to parties to watch the first couple being feted by their friends. But one Friday night, he was invited up to New York, the Plaza Hotel, this beautiful, sumptuous ballroom, and he was being feted by all kinds of people. Example, Lady Esther, she was there with all her diamonds, and this woman had at least, we estimated, about $400,000 worth of gems on her neck and her ears and what have you. She had brought from one of her mansions these silver urns, and there were 50 urns in that ballroom with peach-colored, long-stem roses. And I'm giving you this kind of detail for a reason. People in the audience included people like Whitney Young of the Urban League and all kinds of leaders. Duke Ellington was there. A lot of authors were there. Ralph Allison was there. People from the arts, people from industry. The Fortune 500 board chairman were there. But I was a pool reporter, and a pool is the group of reporters, a smaller group, numbering not more than 10 people, who physically go where the president is, and they report on what the president does to the larger group of White House correspondents, because you can't have 150 people going everywhere. Well, I was a pool reporter, and it was clear that this night had a very strong civil rights theme. And the Secret Service had brought Mrs. Johnson and the president to the entrance that they were going to take them through to get into the ballroom. And as I say, there was a strong civil rights theme that night. And the president and Mrs. Johnson came up, and they were held by the Secret Service until they were getting ready to go through this curtain, which had not been parted yet. And I was standing there with my pencil and notepad, and the president reached out and touched me on the hand and said, "It's good to see you again." And I know, as a human being, that he did that, one, because I was black, and because of the emphasis that night. Just a small thing. Another thing was, before Johnson left office, I had occasion to be in Richard Nixon's White House. Not before he left office, but when President Nixon was in, I was at the White House, again, on a temporary basis. And I remember we were summoned to the Oval Office, and when you go into the Oval Office, you try to get as close as you can to hear what the man is going to say, because a lot of times when people are speaking in low voices in the Oval Office, you can't hear. So I skirted into the office and immediately went around the side of the desk, and I came up to the far corner, left-hand corner of the desk, so that I was closest to the president, and the other reporters were, you know, elbowing and trying to get in closer. Well, the man just dropped a bombshell on us. He announced an appointment to the Supreme Court. And I think it was Judge Clement Haynsworth. He described him as a lawyer's lawyer and a judge's judge, that kind of thing. Well, as we all know, Mr. Haynsworth did not make it, and there was a lot of controversy. But we had had indications that Haynsworth might be a candidate for the highest court in the land, and there were some pieces that had been done in the press, and Mr. Haynsworth's background was not very conducive to what black Americans would consider a jurist who would have their best interests in heart. And as the president was praising his nominee, Mr. Haynsworth, professionally, my right hand was copying down every word, but my mind was thinking, Clement Haynsworth, Supreme Court Justice. And what I found very interesting, I was the only black person in the Oval Office, and I was standing as close to Richard Nixon as you and I are sitting, and the president never once looked at me. Never once. It's the kind of thing that you certainly couldn't document in court. We human beings don't fool one another, right? It was a body English kind of thing. And I know what was in the president's mind. I know why he did not look at me. I could not prove it. I just know it instinctively.
You've covered a lot of national events, the civil rights movement, Dr. King's assassination, I'm quite sure the March on Washington. Has the climate for black America, in your opinion, changed that greatly?
I think it depends on the size of your pocketbook. I think it depends on your job, if you have a job. If you are educated, if you have a profession, I should think that you have continued to do very well. But if you are not educated, if you are a black teenager who hasn't had a job in a long time, I don't see how you can say that things have improved. It depends on the size of your pocketbook and whether indeed you have a pocketbook.
Being the major anchor for CNN here in Washington, is it difficult for you to decide what should be the major story? Is the White House automatically the lead-in story in which you would have on a particular day, or are there other interests here in Washington that you may want America to know about?
It's not difficult. Washington is a news capital of the world. It has a life all its own. And news stories, the leads of newscasts, are decided by the importance or the weight of the news, its importance. It could come out of the White House. The lead could be the latest consumer price index figures. The lead could be a State Department reaction, just a one-paragraph written statement put out in response to something that happened in the Kremlin. The lead could be demonstrators, farmers, demonstrating on Pennsylvania Avenue and being busted up by policemen. It all depends on the weight of the story within the context of other stories that are happening not only here in Washington but across the country and around the world. And it is not a unilateral decision by me. I'm just one of many persons here at CNN. I do not make the final decision. And generally, whatever story is decided on, it gets a number one ranking or a number two or a number three ranking because of its importance within the context of the news flow.
What type of effect did Watergate have on you reporting it and also seeing what it was doing to this country?
That was the most frightening period I have known since being in Washington. And I've been here since 1968. Covering the Watergate story was totally exhausting. It was not a 9-to-5 story. Example, one afternoon on a Saturday, I was assigned to cover the Reverend Carl McIntyre, who was having a big pro-America demonstration and a pro-Nixon demonstration on the grounds of the Washington Monument. And this points up to other people. I'd like to say this to people who are interested in becoming reporters. I remember what Walter Cronkite told me when I was in the Marine Corps back in 1961, and he and I got together and we were talking. He said, you should learn about any and everything, and you should always be alert. Okay, now we go back to the Washington Monument. I was covering this rally, and the producers on the CBS radio network had told me that they wanted a spot, as we call it. They wanted a spot or a report from me for 2 o'clock. So I covered McIntyre for about an hour and a half, and I had enough, and I started walking back towards the White House. I was going to file the report from the White House. That was the nearest relay point that we had physically. And as I was walking back, thinking about how I was going to write the lead, I got close to the White House drive, the South Drive, going around the back of the White House. And I noticed this car, limousine, and I knew that the president, Richard Nixon, had all of the White House correspondents out in the Rose Garden for some kind of ceremony. That was the focus. That was what the White House wanted the press corps in the middle of Watergate to concentrate on, the White House press corps. So as I was walking towards the White House Southwest Gate to get in and write and file my report on McIntyre's demonstration, I noticed this car go by. The only thing I saw was the back of a guy's head in the back seat with a bald spot. And I thought, that's John Mitchell, the Attorney General. What is he doing going to the White House? And I started running. I got past the guards, showing them my Secret Service pass and what have you, White House press pass. And they don't like you to run on the grounds of the White House, but I had to make certain that that indeed was John Mitchell, because at that point in the Watergate story, there was a major controversy about Mitchell's involvement, whether he knew about the plumbers and certain things. Well, in effect, my senses told me that while Richard Nixon has the White House press corps in the Rose Garden, this guy, the Attorney General, is sneaking into the White House for an important meeting about Watergate. These were my theories in my mind. So I ran up the walk, and I said, well, Bernie, you're not going to run 100 yards up there and look into this limousine. The guy will have gotten out and gone into the building. So I stopped. I planted my seat on the sidewalk, my feet on the sidewalk, and I waited to see who was getting out of this car. Indeed, the man got out, receding hairline, the pipe in the mouth. It was John Mitchell, and he went through a side door. I got into our booth at the White House, where Dan Rather and Bob Pierpoint normally work, and they were out in the White House Rose Garden. And I called the assignment desk, and I said, I will do my report on Carl McIntyre, but guess who just sneaked into the White House? John Mitchell. Pandemonium broke out in our bureau. We said, forget about Carl McIntyre. We assigned a courier to watch Mitchell's limousine. We had to find out where he was going. Well, the courier followed this limousine once it left the White House to National Airport. Meanwhile, we asked Ron Ziegler. We went to him privately and said, is the Attorney General in Washington, is the Attorney General here in the White House? Would not confirm or deny that the Attorney General's at the White House. The courier told us that he was getting on a shuttle to New York. Daniel Shore and I raced to the National Airport, got on the same plane. We got on the plane with the crew. And once we were airborne, we walked up and said, we don't want to annoy you or disrupt your flight to New York, but we would like to talk to you. And he promised that he would talk to us in New York at LaGuardia. And we got off the plane, between Shore and I asking him about 15 questions, that's all he would take. It was clear to us that there was a major meeting at the White House. And he said that when his time came to testify, he would testify and he would be cooperating with the Watergate prosecutor. I didn't mean to take so much time.
Go ahead.
But my point was that as a reporter, the slightest thing can be the tip of an iceberg of a major story. And by seeing this bald spot in the back of the head, by knowing who the Washington heavies are, which is your responsibility, there was nothing profound that I did. I was merely doing my job. CBS at that time, we were able to get a major story, which led our show that night. Wires were moving, bulletins, and the newspapers picked it up. But it was a major development at that point during the Watergate story, an indication of how exhausting it was. You know, from walking across the south side of the White House, I ended up in New York that night and came back down on the shuttle with Roger Mudd, who was doing the show that night, I think I got to bed around 1 in the morning, one Sunday morning, but that's an indication of how involved the Watergate story was.
Having worked at three major networks, are the news operations that different from network to network?
No, and a lot of your listeners will say, well, he's right. How many of us have had occasion to look at one network's news program and switch the channel and see the same story? Well, people cover the news generally the same way, aside from what we call enterprise reporting, where you dig and dig and only your listeners in Austin or elsewhere, people listening to the Longhorn Network, know about a certain story. But generally, there's no mystery about covering the news. You know that if the president's going to have a news conference, you're going to cover it, and you're going to report the major things out of it. If Mayor Washington in Chicago is having one of his typical fights with Alderman Edward Berdoliak, and suddenly they're going to have a major summit, you know that's going to be a major story that evening on the evening news, et cetera, et cetera. You do the obvious, you know?
South Africa is a major issue here in Washington at the present time. How is CNN covering that? And are the real, true issues surrounding South Africa and the reason for the protests actually being known to the American public?
Well, we're covering the story as best we can. We felt it was very important that our camera be outside the embassy when Stevie Wonder was arrested. We felt it was important to report that, along with other people who have been arrested, members of Congress, what have you. The story is not just, outside the embassy grounds. We have had the ambassador in on our extended half-hour and hour programs. We've interviewed the ambassador. We've had reports out of Johannesburg. We've had listeners who, viewers who've called in and expressed their opinions about South Africa. In covering the South Africa story, as far as CNN is concerned, it's important to be balanced and to be fair. And that's what we've sought to do.
Two-part question. Your duties and responsibility here at CNN, and how do you go about preparing your nightly newscast?
Well, my responsibilities basically are to hang loose. I'm the principal Washington anchor man, which means I'm on call 24 hours a day. Example, when the savage murder of more than 200 American servicemen occurred in Beirut, guys who were sleeping in their racks over there, when that happened, within a short while of its happening, Daniel Shore and I were walking into this bureau at 4:45 Sunday morning, and we didn't leave until later that afternoon, when the president was shot at by John W. Hinckley here in Washington. We had just carried Mr. Reagan's address to this labor group live, so we were right back there. I didn't get out of the anchor chair until 10 o'clock that night when Air Florida Flight 90 crashed into the Potomac and to the 14th Street Bridge here in Washington. Again, I was on the air 8 to 9 hours. So when major stories occur, my responsibility is to be on call and to be ready and be prepared to come in to help cover them. Preparing for the evening news starts early in the morning.
This has been a tribute to pioneering African-American journalist and former CNN chief anchor Bernard Shaw, who died on September 8, 2022. He was 82. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In our second segment this week on Ebony Spectrum, I'm going to take a peek at two clips. One is from MSNBC, and the other one is from Roland Martin. And, of course, we're talking about religion and politics. Herschel.
Republicans don't care how dumb Herschel Walker is. They don't care. They want power. They will vote for an idiot as long as there's an R in front of his name. Nola, you first.
Yeah. So much to digest here. As a Southerner, you know, I am very proud of that fact. And then sometimes I am just heartbroken. And, you know, I've thought a lot about this, you know, thinking about the way that Herschel Walker is being kind of brought out and just performing. You know, this performative aspect of what he's doing is kind of heartbreaking in a way. You know, it's really, really sad to watch because, you know, I grew up thinking, you know, this man is a legend. And it's baffling to me that so many people, you know, in the Republican space are willing to go out and just completely sully their legacies, you know, and that's the part that's just mind blowing to me. I make absolutely no judgments on, you know, a person's cognitive ability. He may be suffering from some football related injuries, but at the end of the day, this black man who is a legend in his own right, is shuffling and dancing literally on stage, entertaining these people, you know, and we can all kind of visibly see that he's probably not up for the job of being a senator, you know, where, and this other element of, you know, the Christians in Georgia aligning with him, I should be specific and say more white Christians, when you literally have a reverend, running, you know, an incumbent in this position. So again, you know, it's really not about anything other than race, you know, and let's just put it out there. You have one particular type of black man that's running that it's very obvious that people want to control him. And that's the part of it that makes it the most sad. That part is so salient and so obvious that it makes you wonder, what did they promise this man? I really want to know that. Like, what did they promise this man for him to really just be this open to being controlled this way? Because it absolutely makes no sense. So in one regard, you have a person who is clearly going to be controlled by other people. And then on the other hand, you have someone who is very capable, you know, who is an actual reverend. And I love his ads, Roland. I love the ad that you're playing with him and the dog. I mean, it's shade. It's light shade, but I like it. So it's a very interesting situation here. You know, put two black people up against each other and the black people won't know the difference type of thing. That really irritates me. Like you have no idea how much, you know, it's pandering and it's actually very demeaning to the black community in Georgia.
I mean, I know what they're doing. This is power. They don't care. I mean, Ron Johnson, I mean, this fool in Wisconsin, convorting with the Russians. I mean, he is complete. He lies. He's flipped. They don't care. This is what I keep trying to explain to Democrats and progressives. When you are running against people who do not have any morals or values or principles or ethics or character, that only care about power, you better respond accordingly.
Facts.
Renita?
Yeah, Herschel Walker not being a member of Mensa is not a bug. That's a feature for the Republicans. As I tell folks all the time, you would be surprised at how many representatives, and this is on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, don't actually read the bills that they vote on. They just sort of wait to be told how to vote and what to say by the caucus. That's not how I operate as a representative, but unfortunately, that is what a lot of folks do. And so Herschel Walker not running on being scholarly or somebody who is overly concerned with policy is fantastic for Republicans, because what that means is, to your point, Roland, if he gets in, it is 100% total power. He's not going to be looking into the things that he's supporting, and they will 100% be able to control him, and he won't know any better. And so that, you know, Republicans really have sort of, you know, they put him up for one reason and one reason only, and that is because they feel like this is the best way that they can have a shot at getting this seat. And we have heard locally here in Georgia where Republicans from the very beginning were saying, okay, we already know that Warnock is going to be the Democrats' candidate because obviously he's the incumbent. We need a black person too. We need a black man. We need a black for a black. That is what they were saying. So that's why he's there. And for Herschel, it's all upside for him too, because we treat, you know, U.S. senators particularly like rock stars. So, I mean, it's absolutely real that Herschel can win in Georgia. People have to take things very, very seriously. We had depressed turnout for the November 8th election with almost 5% of black voters not showing up from 2018. So we really have got to make sure that everybody understands what is on the line. And I do think that the Warnock campaign has to expressly talk to black voters about why it's important to show up and what he'll do for black voters.
The thing here, Omakongo, again, I keep telling people, This is like a football game. I don't give a damn if you're favored. Again, a lot of people were like, oh my goodness, Tennessee is gonna dog walk South Carolina. Oh, Tennessee, South Carolina has no shot. South Carolina put up 63 on Tennessee on Saturday. Okay, yep. I'm still pained to see the video of North Carolina State beating the University of Houston in the NCAA finals in 1983. Cougars were huge favorites. They lost. So bottom line is, y'all, whoever gets the most votes wins. And folk need to understand that.
Yeah, period, bottom line. And we have to understand also that the Republicans will do anything possible. And like I said, they always got something else that they're scheming on. Last week we talked about, we don't know if Manchin or Sinema will convert and become Republicans. So if they get Walker in, then next thing you know, they're in control. So they always got something else up their sleeves. And when I look at Herschel Walker, I'm just thinking about what Malcolm X said. You know, whenever a black man says something that white people don't like, the first thing they do is get another black person to try to offset what they said. And this is the space that Herschel Walker occupies right now. So sticking with your sports analogy, we got to run it. We got to run the score up in every single way, shape, or form. We got to get out there and not take this for granted. Because if we didn't take this for granted the first time, Warnock should have won on November 8th. Because, you know, clearly a lot of the people who voted for Kemp were not voting for Walker. And now people are saying we just got to go and get him in there because we need that puppet. And we're looking at a guy who just has, forget the intelligence, we already established that, doesn't even have the character. You're talking about a man who takes a woman to go get an abortion, doesn't even go into the clinic, sits in the car, puts a gun to his wife's head. I mean, the list goes on. And the fact that these so-called white evangelicals are siding with him shows that they are at best cafeteria Christians. So every single day, because they're picking and choosing whatever values work for them to help them get power. So every single day, we got to push this hard. And like you said, Roland, we got to support the local organizations on the ground, whether it's phone calls, financially, we got to do it because they're putting in the work and we got to support them because the country is still at stake and we can't get comfortable just because we currently have a slight majority in the Senate.
All right, folks, back to that Roland Unfiltered video in just one moment.
Don't wait till November 8th. We can vote today. Your early vote started this week.
We're on Savannah State University's campus. We'll be dorm storming today, giving our treats for everyone. We hope to see everyone at the polls when it comes to November.
If you believe we got power, let them know. Make some noise. Put a fist up. I need to see a fist in the air because we got power. Come on, you put it up. Come get your shirt.
We're out here in the streets of Savannah, Georgia.
James, do not forget to go vote. I got you. If we vote, the right people in. We can make a change. We can get these resources in our community.
I am a woman, and it is important that we have the say-so of what we want to do with our bodies.
We're concentrating on entrepreneurism, providing young people with resources and training that they need in order to change their trajectories. We want black down.
Democracy's on the ballot. Voting rights is on the ballot. Voting suppression is on the ballot. I am most passionate about those three combined because they all impact each other.
Savannah is my home. I care about my community and I care about representation in my community.
Our voices are still going to be heard no matter what kind of obstacles try to come up against us to stop us from voting. We're still going to be standing our ground.
Effort that's being made to keep our communities from voting. So that makes me realize it's even more important because if it wasn't important, they wouldn't be fighting to make sure we could vote.
This doesn't stop this year. This is a forever movement.
We're going to exert our power as a people. Walk in our rightful place. We're going to change our communities, fight for our communities, and build our communities.
Folks, Black Star Network is here.
Hold no punches!
I'm real revolutionary right now.
Support this man, Black Media. He makes sure that our stories are told.
Thank you for being the voice of Black America, Roland.
All momentum we have now, we have to keep this going.
The video looks phenomenal.
See, there's a difference between Black Star Network and Black-owned media and something like CNN.
You can't be Black-owned media and be scared.
There are just a few more weeks before the final Senate seat is decided in that Georgia runoff between Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. And there have been so many clarifying moments in this campaign. But I'm still thinking about one particular moment. It happened in a church outside Atlanta the Sunday before Election Day.
Ladies and gentlemen, when the Republican Party of Georgia moved Herschel Walker from Texas to Georgia,
so that he could run for Senate. It's because change was taking too fast in the post-antebellum South. They thought we were so slow, that we were so stupid, that we would elect the lowest caricature of a stereotypical broken black man as opposed to somebody who is educated and erudite and focused. Y'all ain't ready for me today. Since Herschel Walker was 16 years old, white men been telling him what to do, telling him what school to go to, where to live, where to eat, where to buy a house, where to run, where to sit down, where to sleep, where to pay for abortions, where to buy a gun. And they, you think they not going to tell him how to vote? In 2022, we don't need a walker. We need a runner.
Pretty powerful and, yes, provocative stuff, I think we can all agree. That was Pastor Jamal Bryant of the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church, absolutely going off on Herschel Walker and his candidacy. Bryant's pulpit message quickly became a viral sensation online, just the latest and most visible of many black faith leaders criticizing Walker for hypocrisy, dishonesty, and cynicism. It even got coverage, as so many trends eventually do, by the New York Times. But how do you suppose the Times framed it? As a possible violation of tax codes by those black faith leaders. Quote, while Mr. Bryan did not directly ask his congregation to vote for Mr. Warnock, his remarks, if interpreted as political speech, may run afoul of a federal rule, the Times helpfully explained. That rule is the 1950s-era Johnson Amendment, which forbids any religious or charitable organizations that are tax-exempt from participating in any campaigns on behalf of political candidates or in opposition to them. It also bans religious leaders from endorsing candidates from the pulpit. Makes sense. You want pastors to speak freely, but you don't want them trading political influence for charitable donations or for part of their untrackable cash haul at the collection plate. It's about separation of church and state. That was the principle at play when the IRS famously denied the Christian Coalition a tax-exempt status back in 1999. The Johnson Amendment is no joke, or at least it used to be no joke.
Now, if you vote Democrat, I don't even want you around this church. You can get out. You can get out, you demon. You can get out, you baby butchering election thief. You cannot be a Christian and vote Democrat in this nation.
The American Socialist Party, aka liberal Democrats, are promising to tax people 70% of their income.
You see any difference when you put left-wing progressives in office? Ladies and gentlemen, if Houston and Harris County is to survive, we had better throw those bums out of office.
I got a candidate that God wants to win. I got a mayor that God wants to unseat.
We break and divide every demonic confederacy against the election, against America, against that who you have declared to be in the White House.
We have two choices in New Mexico. We have the Wicked Witch of the North, or you have Mark Ronchetti. You better get registered to vote, and we better vote her behind right out of office.
That's so weird. That's a parade of white conservative pastors openly politicking for white conservative candidates and causes. One of them, Greg Locke, has even traveled on Mike Flynn's QAnon supporting Christian nationalist roadshow, where he called Democrats, quote, baby butchering mongrels, and bragged about getting them out of his church. How do they get away with it? Well, in recent years, the IRS has largely abdicated its enforcement responsibilities as churches have become more brazen about publicly backing candidates, according to an October investigation by ProPublica and the Texas Tribune. That's because the religious right sees the Johnson Amendment as an attack on their free speech, so much so that Donald Trump tried to shore up his evangelical support with an executive order relaxing the rules on pulpit politicking. It worked for Trump. He got their votes. But the church has never got the Johnson rule overturned in Congress. The point is, predominantly white Christian churches have been politicking openly for conservative causes and candidates for years, with impunity. So why would the New York Times criticize black pastors for weighing in on the Senate race in Georgia, the state where Martin Luther King Jr. and many other black church leaders began a long legacy of political activism that marked the entire civil rights era across the South? Where black churches continue that era's tradition of getting souls to the polls today. This seems to be another cooked-up controversy, a peculiarly one-sided view of a long-time trend in America, a view that just happens to target black activism, where it's been needed most, and black voters, where voting while black is still a fraught endeavor. Pastor Jamal Bryant joins me now. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. Appreciate you coming on the show. You delivered that very viral, very provocative sermon. And then you did that interview for the New York Times, and you said you weren't endorsing Senator Warnock. You added this quote. I just want to read it out. You said, white evangelicals have been very prominent as to who it is that they push and why, he said. But when the black church clears its throat, then we hear, what is the demarcation between church and state? You just heard those white evangelicals, conservatives that I played. Do you believe there is a blatant double standard here? And what is that double standard in your view?
Oh, it's not just a double standard. It's a jumping double dutch. You have seen a whole cavalcade of white evangelicals who tout white Christian nationalism. But if there's even a strand of liberation theology, then it's considered foul play. It's always been historic, going back to the era of slavery, when those preachers are called for the Underground Railroad and for African Americans to realize their freedom. They were called out and were castrated or lynched. White evangelicals have been doing it in time immemorial here in America, and we've seen it no different. And what you're seeing in that article is just the last and latest deposit of it.
So let's agree, Pastor. I think you put it very eloquently there. This is wrong. It's a double standard. But what should the standard be? Is Greg Locke saying Democrats are baby murdering demons just the price of you speaking your truth and staying tax exempt? What do you say to a non-religious progressive who says none of you, whether you're Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, none of you should have tax exemptions if you're going to do politics from the pulpit?
Yeah, I think that what my counterpart said is a whole lot different. What I was doing is an open critique of a public figure and not an endorsement of a candidate. I did not say that all evangelicals or Republicans were going to hell, which is a counter of the theology that they promote. So everyday Georgians are receiving emails and e-blasts and robocalls saying that if you support Senator Warnock, who is for pro-choice, then you cannot be Christian. And I think that is absolutely in error. And I think that America has got to do a different evaluation between Christendom and nationalism.
Let's talk about the vote in this runoff election, because Georgia officials led by Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, we all remember him, have banned early voting the Sunday before the runoff because it's the day after a state holiday. Which state holiday? One that previously honored Confederate General Robert E. Lee's birthday. As a Georgian, as a pastor, as a black man, what do you think when you hear that?
It is in keeping. We have to be clear that HB 202 was passed not because of voter fraud, but because of voter turnout. In the last election cycle, when Senator Warnock was duly elected, it was a higher turnout in Georgia than for the presidential election. And so they came together and conspired amongst themselves. How could they stop it? As a consequence, they made Souls to the Polls elective. As a consequence, they made it illegal to give water to those who are waiting in line or assistance to those who are physically challenged. That's not for voter fraud, but it is to suppress black, brown, and young voters. But we are really focused that the helm and the heart of America on the line, and you're getting ready to see on December 6th a voter turnout as Georgians have never seen before.
So Senator Raphael Warnock is also a pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the same post once held by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And yet Warnock is getting savaged by Herschel Walker, by evangelical conservatives in Georgia and beyond, as an immoral, irresponsible socialist. But the right said the same thing about Dr. King before they venerated him after he died, didn't they?
Yeah, it is amazing that they are accusing Senator Warnock of what Herschel Walker is guilty of. Reverend Warnock has held a life of pristine character, holding to high moral integrity, and they have swept all of Herschel Walker's missteps under the rug until there's a lump in the carpet. But his character and moral fiber are without question.
White evangelicals have a firm grip on the Republican Party, and for good reason. They serve as a reliable and solidly Republican voting bloc. But here's the thing. Americans have been turning their backs on conservative Christianity. The U.S. is growing less religious and less white, and white evangelicals are also losing a powerful segment of American voters who are rejecting their platform, namely young voters. Younger Americans, the most diverse demographic in this country, are less likely to sign up for, say, supporting Trump or upholding white Christian supremacy. Researchers at Tufts estimate that voters between the ages of 18 and 29 had the second highest turnout in midterm elections in almost 30 years. And white voters in that age group defied the demographic history and voted in the majority for Democrats. According to a recent Harvard Youth poll, only 12% identify as fundamentalist evangelical. I mean, it makes sense, right? Young people grew up in a more tolerant society. They've seen a black president, more women and LGBTQ members of Congress. And they are recoiling at attempts by older white evangelicals, including on the Supreme Court, to try to snatch away their freedoms and their self-determination. It's quite the bind, isn't it? But one of white evangelicals' own making. The religious right is in decline, and the rest of America refuses to go down with them. Because there isn't much Jesus in the religious right anymore. It's all about cruelty politics, being anti anything that isn't them. It's about putting up walls, fearing refugees rather than helping them. It's about eradicating the existence of LGBTQ people. It's about the unbelievably inhumane consequences of their forced birth crusade, which has nothing to do with life, let's just be clear, and everything to do with a raw contempt for modern women and girls. You know what's actually in the Bible? The call to compassion, to love, tenderness, and courtesy, characteristics that are woefully absent in the culture wars, but especially in the war against wokeness. You know what wokeness really is at its core? It's empathy, something Republicans don't seem to understand or care for, but something Richard Fierro, one of the heroes who took down the gunman in the Club Q shooting, displayed so courageously in the wake of a hate crime.
I grew up around so a mix of everything, and being able to share and exchange cultures, that's part of being American. Much like the beer summit with that Obama did, those are things that for us as people that sell beer, people that have people with libations, right, want people to have fun. But at the end of the day, you want to shake hands and love each other. You know, that's what it's all about.
We just heard from Joy Reid, Mehdi Hasan, both from MSNBC and also from Roland Martin from his program yesterday. Rick and I want to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. Please be safe. Take care of yourself and others. Look out for those less fortunate than yourselves. Of course, the opinions expressed here on Ebony Spectrum and on in Black America are not those of WRCT, its staff, or management. And we welcome your questions and comments. You can write us at publicaffairs@WRCT, or you can email Rick and I. You can email me at kamos54@gmail.com or rick@theradioactivists@prodigy.net. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week, and have a safe holiday. I'm here outside when you're ready. When you're ready for me. Bring out the shots and confetti. I'll take you home if you let me. Yeah. Just promise you won't forget me. No, 'cause the days get better when you're here, so I gotta keep you near. Going crazy and I just can't get you out of my head. I've seen the atmosphere, I can feel it in the air. Getting crazy and I just can't get you out of my head.
This is G. Gordon Liddy. I urge you to tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 on your FM dial. If you don't, I'll break both your legs.